Hi everyone, welcome back to this podcast series on the life of Lucius Annaeus Seneca. This is podcast 9 and it will cover the Consolatio ad Polybium. Our time frame is late AD 43 to early AD 44. Seneca has been exiled to Corsica, probably to the well-established Roman colonia of Illyria, a port city on the Tyrrhenian Sea facing the Italian mainland. Despite its relative proximity to Rome and long exposure to Latin culture, Seneca's writings, known to have been written on the island of his exile, are full of negative impressions. He calls it a barren rock, filled with natives and foreigners alike, making a din in barbarous tongues. Seneca's dismissive and gloom-ridden complaints about Corsica were, of course, massively exaggerated. Illyria couldn't possibly have been as bad as Seneca's word pictures painted it to be. But what he wrote was clearly tainted by his state of mind, and that was one of extreme frustration. The one thing that Seneca wanted above all else he couldn't have. He was absolutely desperate to get back to Rome. At this point in time, Seneca had been stuck on Corsica for around 2 years. Claudius's wife, Messalina, had accused Seneca of adultery with the emperor's niece, Julia Lavilla, back in AD 41. It was Julia, with her growing closeness to Claudius, who was actually Messalina's main target, so perhaps Seneca had been implicated because he was convenient and easy bystander. He was, after all, known to be an associate of Julia and her sister Agrippina. Or maybe it was a historical slight. Perhaps some of Seneca's relatives, the Annaei, suspected to have been sympathisers of a faction that continued to support Tiberius's obnoxious and notorious henchman Sejanus, even after his death in AD 31, had somehow offended members of Messalina's clan? Or was Seneca guilty as charged? Did he, in reality, have an adulterous relationship with Julia? I guess we'll never know. What I do know, though, is that Seneca was very deeply affected by the charge of adultery, because he continued to rant and rail against impudicitia and infidelitas, that sexual impurity and faithlessness, for the rest of his writing life. Did that indicate genuine righteous indignation that he'd been falsely accused? Or was it a case of, methinks the gentleman doth protest too much? My personal opinion is that Seneca was simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. But then again, hypocrisy, writing one thing while doing something totally different, was something Seneca was to become virtually synonymous with. There would always be a tension between what Seneca wrote and how he behaved, and it's this glaring discrepancy, saying one thing while being seen to do its opposite, that has mystified so many Senecan scholars down the ages. It also confused the hell out of many of his contemporaries, but that's a topic for a future podcast. Whatever the real reason behind his exile, Seneca was on Corsica in late AD 43 to early AD 44. He was under no illusion that the longer he was kept from Rome, the smaller his chances for political advancements and a literary fame. He was caught between a rock and a hard place. If he wrote anything overtly political, Messalina would get wind of it and make his life even more miserable. It is possible that he wrote some of his dramas over the 8 odd years he was to spend on Corsica in total, but as they are, by their very nature and content, completely undateable, it's difficult to say for sure. Nevertheless, Seneca did produce some work here. In AD 43, Claudius, feeling the need to legitimise his principate by taking the time-honoured Roman course of accruing prestige and glory by invading somebody or other, sent his general, Aulus Plautius, along with 4 legions to Britain. True, Britain had been harbouring fugitives and seditionists from already conquered Gaul, and Claudius had agreed to help a deposed British tribal chief regain his authority. But it's pretty obvious that Claudius saw the country as fairly easy meat and, therefore, a relatively painless path to military glory, especially since the Germans had wiped out the territorial gains made by the Romans east of the River Rhine after annihilating 3 legions under Publius Varus in AD 9. Besides, Britain's natural resources, such as tin, made it a worthwhile target. The conquest of much of the south and east of the country was achieved swiftly enough for Claudius himself to make a 16-day dash to Camulodunum, modern-day Colchester in Essex, to accept the final surrender of, that is reported, 11 British kings. There's even the suggestion that Claudius turned up in Britain with a contingent of war elephants, and we can only imagine the overawing effect those beasts would have had on tribal chieftains for whom horse-drawn chariots and dogs trained for war was as good as it got. Having thoroughly intimidated the natives, Claudius returned to Rome, where he was awarded a triumph for his magnificent victory. Seneca, stuck on his barren Mediterranean rock, and probably kept up to date with regular missives from Rome and elsewhere, could only look on and seethe, his frustration boiling over that he had no part to play in these momentous events. Claudius would be basking in the glow of victory. The fact that he'd only turned up to receive the defeated king's surrender was neither here nor there to a senate keen to curry favour with its boss. And Claudius would be amenable to requests for magnanimity. In other words, it was a golden opportunity for a well-timed piece of flattery to reap a generous reward. But Messalina had Claudius's ear, and while she was still around, Seneca knew he'd never get near enough to the emperor to make a plea for recall from exile. Fate, however, intervened and opened the door to Claudius just enough to make Seneca think he stood a chance. One of Claudius's most trusted advisers, a freedman secretary by the name of Polybius, experienced the death of his younger brother, an event which prompted Seneca to author a consolation to the bereaved party. It's known as the Consolatio ad Polybium, or a consolation to Polybius, and, as with many works of the same genre in ancient times, it was intended for publication and wider circulation. By authoring such a work, one that was supposedly non-political, Seneca hoped that he would bypass Messalina's censorship radar and, at the same time, get in a personal plea to Claudius, who, he hoped, would read a work dedicated to somebody so close to himself and who belonged to his inner circle. Seneca had tried the same sort of thing on before, of course, when he wrote the consolation to Marcia back in the first half of Caligula's reign. Then, in my opinion, he was using the fact that a work of consolation would be relatively widely circulated to broadcast his loyalty to the children of the deceased but still widely venerated Germanicus, that is, to Agrippina, Julia, and even to Caligula himself. But this time around, 2+ years into his Corsican exile, Seneca had to do more than broadcast his loyalties. This time around, Seneca had to somehow incorporate a personal begging letter to the emperor into a work of condolence to a man he may or may not even have met. And Seneca, I'm afraid to say, didn't manage it very well at all. In fact, it was a right old botch job. He started off okay, the standard philosophical putting of grief, a transient emotion, into perspective against the periodic crashing and rebuild of the universe and the rise and fall of cities and civilizations. He explained that it is the way of nature, an immutable law in fact, to give each thing a beginning and end. So far, so good. But then the toadian started, the fawning, and it all went way over the top. Seneca started to lay it on thick. He made an imaginary address, a rhetorical technique called an apostrophe, to Fortuna, a very ancient goddess, whose remit covers that whole murky area that we might call luck, good luck, bad luck, and everything in between. Seneca accused Fortuna of finding the only possible thing that could hurt Polybius, the death of his brother. She couldn't get him on wealth, he says, because Polybius was no slave to money. She couldn't rid him of friends, because Polybius was so lovable, he'd always be able to make new ones. She couldn't get him on reputation, because that was beyond reproach, and he was, in addition, a brilliant and respected author of works written in both Latin and Greek. And this is where Seneca's praise rises to a crescendo of sycophantic fawning, and these are his words. So long as letters shall have any honour, he writes, so long as the force of the Latin or the grace of the Greek tongue shall survive, Polybius shall flourish in the company of those giants of whose genius he has made himself a rival. Polybius, it appears, had reworked some Greek epics into Latin and vice versa, a commendable achievement, but not, you'd suppose, enough to catapult him into the front ranks of ancient literary geniuses. And needless to say, Polybius's literary achievements, his genius, are totally unknown outside of Seneca's mentions of them. Seneca does pay some lip service to what should be the main thrust of the consolation, that is, cataloguing the merits of the deceased. He even returns briefly to the standard practice of offering grief management techniques as seen through the lens of philosophy. It's all the normal stuff. The deceased either wouldn't want Polybius to grieve or was beyond caring that he did, so either way, grieving was futile. Polybius was to keep a stiff upper lip for his public profile and so on and so forth, normal stuff. But it doesn't take Seneca much longer to move on to the real reason he singled out Polybius for all of this verbal blancmange. Totum de Caesari debes, he says to Polybius, you owe the whole of yourself to Caesar. So long as Caesar is alive, your dear ones are alive. You have lost nothing. And if you haven't got your fingers down your throat just yet, wait a bit. It gets worse, much worse. Seneca bids Polybius look to Claudius when tears threaten to overwhelm him. Fix your eyes upon Caesar, he says. At the sight of the exceeding greatness and splendour of his divinity, they will be dried. His brilliance will dazzle them so that they will be able to see nothing else. So great is his kindness, so great is his gracious favour to all his followers. I do not doubt he has already covered over this wound of yours with many balms. May gods and goddesses grant him a long earthly life. Seneca goes on and on in the same vein. He calls upon Fortuna again, extolling her to praise Claudius and the way he is repairing the damage wrought by his predecessor Caligula. He wishes for him a future packed with triumphs to rival those of Claudius's own father, Germanicus. And it's at this very point in the work that Seneca begins to drop all pretense that this piece of literature, this consolatio, is about anything else other than Seneca fishing for a recall from exile. Because right here, in the middle of this encomium, this pain, this lavish praise he's heaping on Claudius, Seneca extraordinarily starts to plug his own case. It's a reckless strategy, a pretty desperate throw of the dice, and it's a move almost breathtaking in its barefaced cheek. It's difficult to draw a modern-day comparison, Perhaps a letter of condolence to a bereaved sibling with whom you've fallen out, which contains a request for a financial loan, might come close. With historical hindsight, however, and despite its remarkable nature, it was probably the only approach Seneca could take, especially with Messalina prowling around the edges. It was, all things considered, the only option he had open to him at the time. But he stuffed it up. Segueing on awkwardly from wishing Claudius many triumphs, Seneca then goes straight on to suggest it might not be too much to hope that he himself might be a spectator at the upcoming triumph for the British conquest in Rome. He reminds Claudius of the emperor's intervention at Seneca's trial, in which the sentence was mitigated from execution to exile, and he suggests that Claudius might like to reverse even that. For Claudius, he asserts, has not cast me down with no thought of ever lifting me up. Seneca pleads with Claudius to recognize his innocence, or if he can't do that, then to show him kindness and mercy. The great consolation of my own wretchedness, continues Seneca, is to see Claudius's compassion spreading over the whole world. And since, even in this remote corner in which I am planted, his mercy has unearthed many who were buried under a downfall that came long years ago, and he has restored them to light, I do not fear that I shall be the only one it will pass over. And so it goes on for several more passages. Seneca just knows that Claudius will come to his rescue. Claudius treats exiles far more mercifully than the previous monster Caligula. Claudius is the universal consolation of all mankind. Claudius's immense learning and habitual eloquence have consoled Polybius. Claudius points to many Roman heroes of the past, as well as recent members of his own clan who have lost siblings, as examples of bearing grief with dignity. And for this last part, Seneca even has the gall to have Claudius delivering the lesson in his own voice. This, of course, is a very obvious attempt at remote psychoengineering. Seneca was hoping that if he put enough clemency and forgiveness into his portrayal of Claudius, it would prompt Claudius to act in that very fashion, especially when his reign was compared so favourably to that of Caligula's, the Julio-Claudian whom everyone loved to hate. Seneca was attempting to create a self-fulfilling prophecy, an image of a beneficent Claudius dispensing mercy and clemency throughout the Roman world and beyond, of which Seneca himself would be a grateful recipient. For what was probably appearance's sake, that is, given a final nod to the consolation literary genre, Seneca rounded off the Consolatio ad Polybium with some standard consolation Stoic philosophical material. But he couldn't resist a parting shot. He probably didn't mean his concluding paragraph to come across in such a pathetic, poor me, I'm so hard done by tone, but he did, and it is. Just listen to this. I have put these things together as best I could, with a mind now weakened and dulled by long rusting. If they should seem to you to be ill-suited to your intelligence, or to ill supply the healing of your sorrow. Reflect how he who is held fast in the grip of his own misfortunes is not at leisure to comfort others, and how Latin words do not suggest themselves readily to one in whose ears the uncouth jargon of barbarians is ever ringing, distressing even to the more civilized barbarians among them. Well, at this point, I should point out that Seneca's appeal to Claudius for mercy, although rather clumsily buried in a consolation to another man, is not quite as amateurish as it first appears. This was, after all, a period of Roman history in which high-flown rhetoric, often at the expense of subtlety, was the norm. despite the dictates of Stoicism that emotions were best kept under strict control. Roman interactions were often highly charged emotional affairs. What I'm saying is that Seneca's very obvious approach here in the Consolatio ad Polybium would not have been considered particularly unusual. In fact, were it to have been addressed to a government official of the previous regime and a direct appeal made to the uber-dramatic Caligula, especially if he were basking in the adulation of a successful military campaign, there's a chance it might have paid off. Sure, with Caligula, there was also the chance it would have been the last thing Seneca ever wrote before he found himself horribly tortured or murdered. But there would have been a chance. Where Seneca went wrong here was in underestimating Claudius. Claudius was too long in the tooth, too cynical, too used to protecting his own backside to fall for a thinly veiled Hail Mary attempt for forgiveness and recall like Seneca's. To Claudius's well-practiced, well-educated ear, the Consolatio ad Polybium would have stank of sycophancy and desperation. He'd have seen right through it. What Seneca failed to take into consideration also was what Polybius meant to Claudius on a personal level. Their actual relationship, that is. Claudius had survived to become emperor because he'd surrounded himself with loyal and intelligent servants like Polybius. In my opinion, he would not have taken at all kindly to somebody like Seneca attempting to shanghai the grief of a man he in all likelihood loved and trusted for what was ultimately a very selfish and personal end. The silence of the historical record on the matter makes it very clear that Seneca's appeal for recall from exile fell on deaf ears and was totally ignored. So, we've come now to the end of this little excursion into the Consolation to Polybius. It wasn't Seneca's best work. In fact, it was a complete disaster. He'd underestimated his audience and his theme. Moreover, and perhaps more importantly, he'd overestimated his own importance and appeal. Seneca was abandoned on Corsica for another 4 to 5 years. Over that period, he didn't stop writing. But things were beginning to change in Rome as Messalina, Seneca's erstwhile nemesis, started to test exactly how far she could push her luck. She'd ultimately hit a brick wall. What that would mean to Seneca, I'll explain in the next podcast. I'll hopefully see you there.